the best coaches in the game. We really ain't playing. We regroup up in the Slack chat where the coaches debrief. We be piecing these puzzles, occupy the chunk of the pie. Ain't no lie when we hit the block, helmets casket is top. You be seeing helmet after helmet, helmet after helmet. First place, second place, fifth place, eighth place, 12th place, 15, 16, 20. So many helmets, you got blurred vision, we got too many.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Beat the Bookie podcast, episode 15, brought to you by SportsBetArmy.com. SportsBetArmy from the brilliant minds over at DFS Army. It is a website that we launched not too long ago, and then all sports stopped. So we've had a chance to fine-tune it, and I'm here with one of the lead coaches, the star of the show, Mr. John Alicia. How are you, my friend?
Doing well. How you doing?
Good, good, good. I'm Alan Zislowski. I'm one of the fantasy football analysts over at DFS Army. But for those of you who are finding us for the first time, because I found that some people are kind of accidentally bumping into us, John, why don't you just start by giving them a little bit of like a one-minute version of your background, your resume, and tell them why they should be listening to you when it comes to sports wagering advice.
I am a long-time sports bettor since high school, but really college, started taking it more seriously. And then I had a 25 some odd year career on Wall Street trading currencies. So I have a pretty good background. I've spent pretty much my whole professional life in risk gambling because when you're trading, anything you're trading has a very close correlation to what we do in the gambling world, whether it be poker or sports betting. Anytime you're taking risk, there's a lot of similarities. So, people didn't see it back then as far as when I used to tell them, well, I'm going to play poker. And they're like, well, you know, they didn't build those hotels on winners. And now, of course, everybody understands that poker players can actually win money. And I think we're going to start seeing the same sort of thing happen with sports betting, where most people think every sports bettor is a loser, which
many are.
A good significant part of the population are, but same thing goes with poker. Most people are losers when they play poker as well, but you can win at sports betting.
Yeah, and if you're finding us again for the first time, this is our 15th episode. You can go back into the DFS Army feed, podcast feed, and find some of our what we call evergreen episodes. John did a great job all of last fall and winter of basically giving you actionable advice, not picks necessarily, but ways to fix leaks in your game, how to manage a bankroll, and things like that. And that leads us into our topic today. We're going to talk about how to calculate risk. And I know specifically you wanted to talk about how that relates to reopening the economy. So we can start this anywhere you want. You want to define risk or how, like, your basic metrics when you calculate it, or you can just jump right into the bigger thing at hand, which is the economy, and it's about to reopen from the pandemic.
Yeah, it's just something I've been thinking about for the last few weeks when we're talking about the situation that's going on. And again, for those maybe watching this in the future, hopefully things are a lot better than they are right now. But we're here on Memorial Day weekend, 2020, and most places are still either on, you know, some form of either a lockdown or we have a limited opening of the of businesses and economies. Down here in Florida, we restaurants are at like 50% max capacity. You still can't go to bars, things like that. So now I know there's a huge political angle here, but let's try to put the political aside. And really, what this comes down to is sort of a risk. It's a risk analysis. And what I found interesting, I heard this from, so I'd like to take credit for myself, but I heard this from someone else, and I hadn't thought about it. First, let me start. You know, risk is just something that's very individualistic, right? So what I consider to be a risky behavior for myself, let's say, you may not find risky, or vice versa. So I'm not going to jump out of a plane in one of those flying squirrel suits anytime soon, because I just think that
it's crazy. You know,
the chances of me dying are pretty significant, assuming that I even had the skills to do it.
Right, but even if you do it, like, the experience of the upside is not worth the downside.
Right,
to you,
for me. But there are people out there who say, listen, I'm willing to risk death, and they know that that's what they're risking. I'm willing to risk that high probability of death for that whatever experience they get and whatever adrenaline rush they get. Now, there's a reason there's a very small portion of the population who does that. But we take, you know, like I said, we look at risk in a different way. Now, if I knew for a fact that, let's say, I forget the exact number right now, but we're a little over, I guess, about 100,000 deaths. Let's say I could.
From the pandemic.
From the pandemic that have been calculated. And I'm not going to get into any of the politics of how accurate the numbers are or anything like that. Let's just assume everything that we're reading is perfectly accurate. And now let's assume that we knew for a fact that we were going to, that if we just fully opened up and went back to whatever normal is, you know, February type activity, this never happened, and we open everything up in New York, everywhere, and we knew for a fact that we were going to lose, let's say, 200,000 more people, and that would be the end of it, you would still have a debate, right? There would still be people out there who would say, well, you know, one person is too many. 50,000, you know, there's going to be some sort of debate, while there's going to be other people who say, listen, that's a small price to pay for not destroying the entire country.
Right.
So what I really wanted to get at is the, you know, when I talk about risk and bankroll management, when we talk about sports, and you'll hear the other guys over there, Anthony and Ryan, you know, we talk about that. It's very much, you have to take that approach of what can you handle? What's your risk tolerance? And then there's another aspect of this that I thought about. There's a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. I don't know if you've ever heard of it by
No, I haven't.
Jonathan Haidt. He's an NYU professor and liberal left-leaning guy, but he noticed, you know, if you have seen a lot of these stories over maybe the last 4 or 5 years on college campuses, the safe spaces and the you know, people being offended by words, things that you hadn't heard maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago. He was taking notice of it at NYU, and he, you know, I'll give you a quick summation of it. You know, he wrote this book, and his theory was it started somewhere around, I believe, 2000, I want to say either 2011 or 2013, I'm forgetting, but that's when he started to really see things change. And the reason being, in his estimation, was the advent of social media. So the kids coming into college at that time had started, those were the first kids who had started to grow up on Facebook and Twitter and all these social media outlets. So he equates some of that and then some of the parenting that we do. If you're a parent, I highly suggest reading the book, because and the reason I bring this up is we are eliminating risk from our children.
Right.
As much as we possibly can. Now, that sounds like a great thing, right? We don't want to put our kids, you have children, right? You don't want to, right? You have children, Alan?
No, I do not.
Oh, you do not. Okay. Yeah. I don't either. Yeah, yeah. But I have my nieces and nephews who, in my mind, are, you know, are the world.
People we care about, though. I mean, you know.
Of course. So you always have this fear of, you know, if they do, you know, for a kid to do something risky, maybe, you know, in my day, back when I was a kid, you know, in Brooklyn, at 9 and 10 years old, I was able to ride my bike through the streets of Brooklyn, you know, not all
come
over
home,
the place, but go a
right.
few blocks to my friend's house and in the streets.
We got into white vans that were asking us if we wanted candy.
We no did. Problem. Life was actually riskier then, or it was actually more dangerous then. And we were allowed to do more things. And as like my generation had children, they started to become more and more protective. You've seen this happen, you know, the peanut allergy thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was we saw this huge increase in peanut allergies in the Western world. There was one country that didn't have that increase, and it was Israel. Now, I don't know if you know why, but they figured out why Israel was the only Western country.
You have me intrigued. You have me intrigued.
Well, the reason Israel didn't have this was because the actual snack that they would, the most popular snack that they gave little kids was peanut based. Like here, if you've ever seen, if you know anyone who had little kids, they have like these rice based, I believe they're rice based little crackers that they give the kids. It's one of the first things that they eat, like solid type of food. It's not peanut based. In Israel, it was peanut based. So exposing them to more, you know, risk actually was reducing the amount of peanut allergies because they were building up a tolerance.
It's similar. It must be similar to like rolling around in dirt in a sandbox when you're a kid.
That's exactly right. So if you're at, and there's a lot of talk about this quarantine, is are we actually putting ourselves at greater risk by trying to reduce the risk? Because now we're not exposing people who have been locked down for weeks and months here, are not being exposed to other forms of bacteria and things like that. So if you actually live in a bubble, you are way more susceptible to diseases when you're now exposed to them.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So there's talk about that, where maybe that's prolonging the pandemic amount of cases in the areas that are on the tightest lockdown. I don't know. You know, these are theories right now. No one really has the answer, but it's interesting. But we do know in certain aspects of life, when you try to eliminate as much risk as possible, what you wind up doing is making things worse.
So I have a question for you. So let's circle that back to what's going on currently with the economy. So what are you saying that by telling people to stay home, or are you telling people get out there? How does the government use what you're saying, this risk calculation, to find out what the right thing is to do? Is it different in every city? Should it be one blanket rule? Like, that's what I'm interested to hear your risk assessment calculation with.
Well, it's, you know, I wish I had the exact answer. I mean,
well, your theory, not even an answer.
My theory is, certainly from a risk standpoint, we're taking a greater risk in losing the economy and losing people. There are people that we're losing as a result of either the economy tanking, the fact that they're stuck at home, losing their job. You know, when you have 30 plus million people losing their job, there's actually a calculation for the amount of suicides. There's a direct correlation, the amount of suicides and the unemployment rate. Top of my head, I'm forgetting exactly what that calculation is. But every million people that you have on unemployment, suicide goes up.
The reason being percentage. That people think like they don't have a sense of purpose, or they're, you know, they see their situation as grave. They can't, you know, so they get depressed.
Exactly. The obvious is obviously, you know, just not being able to provide for your family leads to depression. But you said a really great thing there, where not having a sense of purpose. I think what's often missed by people is a lot of people say, boy, I wish I never had to work again. And I know most people who retired never really retire. Right, they do something else, because retiring, you lose that sense. The best way to die in old age is to retire, sit at home, and do nothing. Like, you will almost assuredly die young. If you don't have activities in your life that you're interested, whether it's volunteering, hobbies,
I think,
or getting a little job, you know, working at Home Depot.
I think when people say they don't want to work anymore, what they really mean is they don't want to have to work
anymore.
That's
exactly right. That's exactly right. There's a difference. There's a huge difference, and most people don't want to work at the particular job that they're working at. But yes, there's a sense of it's as if right now some people are saying the only goal in life is to stay alive. Like, if you wake up every day, before this ever happened, I don't think any of us, most of us, the overwhelming majority of us, did not wake up every day and say, boy, I hope I make it through the end of the day alive. Like, we just don't think that way. Now, of course, that's changing in people's minds. Like, everything, you know, I don't want to touch anything, I'm going to die, you know, which is not a great way. It's not living at all, in my opinion. I wish I had the right answer. And like I said, if we knew exactly how many people might potentially die, we would still have a debate. There would still be people that said,
hey,
well,
is it worth,
you know, 150,000, right? Yeah, 150,000 more people or 200,000 more people is not worth
killing the economy, right?
Isn't that? And then the other people would have the opposite view. So it's an interesting dynamic. And on most of these things, I always err on the side of libertarianism, where, you know, kind of, as long as you're not hurting someone else, you do you, and I'll do my thing. And as long as I don't infringe on your rights. What's interesting here is I potentially am infringing on your rights,
right?
Because
right,
I could potentially get you sick, where I'm not living. I can't live in a bubble. So it's a very, you know, it's interesting. We'll be talking about this for hundreds of years, but I don't have the right answer, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But it really comes down to a risk. If you could throw the political aspect out of it, which is impossible to do in real life, this comes down to a risk assessment.
Okay. So I have a question for you now. This is pivoting a little bit. So if you want to, do you have anything more you want to say about this specific subject? Because I have.
No, it's fine. No,
okay. Yeah. So this one, as it relates to the NFL and home field advantage with no fans, and how this is a question I've been getting a lot from a sports betting angle. And I told some people that I would bring it up with you on this podcast, and basically is, you know, the standard home field advantage in the NFL, which presumably will have no fans this year, is 3 points. So is that 3 points still going to be there, or is that just like kind of the average is 3 points? And normally, you know, some are 3.3 points. Are there 2.8 points? So talk about how that's going to be baked into the line if there's literally no fans.
Yep, I'll give you the answer, and I've touched on this on previous podcasts, whether it was this one or when we do the Vegas lines, the Geeks Vegas lines. The home field advantage is not because teams get to sleep in their own bed. It is directly, there's a direct correlation between the fans in all sports and, more importantly, the referees. So the fans influence the referees. That changes the home field advantage. You say 3 points. It was 3 points forever. When we were growing up, it was always 3 points.
Right.
It's now dropped, even with before all this, right? So I don't have it in front of me, but we were, I believe, less than 2.5 points as a home field advantage last year. Hmm. Do you know the reason why that is? Why the home field advantage has dropped?
Well, I mean, just based on what you just said, my best guess would be that is there more fans traveling? Is there, I mean, nope. Or... Okay, so tell me.
The answer. It's replay. Mm. So you're getting more and more critical plays in a game reviewed. So the more we institute technology into all sports, you'll see the home field advantages drop. The greatest home field or home court advantage in any sport was always the NBA. I believe for years it was about 58%. And what was interesting about that was if you looked at home field advantage in basketball throughout the world, the Israeli league, the Chinese leagues, the leagues in Greece, wherever, they all had about a 57-58% home court advantage. Same thing happened in soccer. There's pretty soccer is actually a bigger home field advantage,
right,
than the NBA. Now you wonder, why would the NBA possibly have a bigger home court advantage than the NFL? It doesn't make any sense. There is absolutely, of all the sports, there is no advantage from a strategic standpoint of playing at home or playing on the road. You could say with the NFL, the crowd noise affects the offensive signal calls. You could say in baseball, I get the last at bat. In hockey, I've got the advantage of being of having the second line change in hockey. So there are strategic advantages in all sports. The NBA, you can't name one other than the fact that some guy might be waving a sign while you're shooting free throws.
As somebody who referees high school basketball, I could, you know, I know exactly where you're going here. Like, the crowd has power over a calls. And if you're a human being, I mean, I'll let you 100%. Finish this up. But yeah, I mean, and the crowd's right there in your face.
That's right. And now you bring the key point up. What they then figured was the proximity to the playing surface the fans are, the closer they are, the bigger the influence was over the game. So if you're a baseball umpire out at second base, I mean, you're so far removed from the fans,
right?
It has less of an impact. Therefore, baseball, which has a great strategic advantage of batting last, the home field advantage in baseball was always very minimal. But again, as a basketball referee, you know, if you're in a packed gym, you're not intentionally doing it, but it's real tough to make that ticky-tack tight call down against the home team when you've got people breathing down your neck. It's actually something I wanted to look at, and it's hard because everything, if you have data, you can do these things. But in the UFC, I'm curious, and in boxing, the judges are not next to each other, so they're at different places in the ring. I'm curious to know
three different angles.
If the judges do judges judge the fights differently based on their proximity to the corners that they are. So if they're close to one corner, do they judge? And my hypothesis is they will, in fact, they'll sweat. You know, when you see these unusual decisions, is it maybe the judge sitting closest to one corner that's giving them preferential scoring, only because a lot of these judges don't realize what they're watching? they don't fully understand the sport. They've never done the sport. It's not like baseball or football where these guys presumably have actually played the sport. They have an understanding. It's very different in boxing and MMA. Where they get some of these judges from is, that's a whole other topic.
But the whole idea, just not to pivot too much off, but they're using boxing judges, especially in the beginning of UFC, and they're using boxing rules for yes. UFC, which, excuse me, but go ahead.
Watching, I'm not an MMA expert from the standpoint of I couldn't go out there and grapple right now with someone in the street and know exactly what I'm doing. But as you watch it more, you understand a little bit more. But it's, from the first one, Hoist Gracie, when I was watching the first UFCs, he was on his back, and as someone who had never seen this before, it looked like, he was
toast. He
was about to get destroyed. Meanwhile, he had the guy right where he wanted him.
Exactly. Yeah.
Even being on his back. So I think I think the grappling aspect of it, these judges don't understand. But not to I know we're off on a tangent, but yes,
yeah, that's fine.
That's the what my anticipation is with no fans at any sport is it will reduce the home field advantage to virtually nothing. There was actually studies done in Europe. It happens quite a bit in soccer where and not that it was a study, but we've seen it happen where they'll ban fans. You've got these hooligan fans and they'll be some sort of riots or something like that. And then that team is not allowed to have fans anymore, home fans. And then we've seen the home field advantage drop to virtually none when a team has no fans. They also did studies with soccer referees where they watched the game. They had soccer referees watching a game and calling fouls on television. With the volume on and with the volume off.
Wow.
And with the volume on, they were calling more fouls against the visiting team than they were when the volume was off, they called it pretty much down the line. So there's a subconscious influence fans have over refereeing.
Yeah, no, that's unbelievable. So yeah, going back to high school sports, they were saying that in the state I live in Florida, that there may not even be, there's not going to be fans if there is high school sports this season. So from a referee's perspective, what you're saying, I'm actually looking forward to that.
Yeah, referees, fans are, I've done a little bit of it in my life, not yeah. often. I umpired a few games. Yeah, not having fans is definitely ideal for for any sort of official in a game.
So, but, okay, go ahead, John.
I was just going to get back on the...
get back on it, go ahead.
On rest, just how we can bring it back. I think, one other thing about risk is, and I guess we touched on it a little bit, is the more you eliminate risk, people do riskier things. It's been proven if you wear a helmet on a motorcycle, you'll drive faster.
That's wild, man, right there. Okay, so... Yeah, no, that is crazy. You're right. You'll feel like that you're more protected when in reality you're not. It's like it would be like closing your eyes driving just because you have a seatbelt on.
That's right. That's right. And you talk about cars, race car drivers, they will push the limit now, NASCAR drivers, more than they ever could have 20 years ago because these cars are so insanely safe. We had Ryan Newman had an accident in January, February that looked unbelievable. And he's
30 years ago.
He's back to racing. Yeah, which was 3-4 months ago. He's back racing.
But I'm saying 30 years ago, what would that accident?
Oh, no. 30 years ago, there was no
way
he
would have
survived.
Right?
There was no way he would survive. He got T-boned, by a guy going 150 miles per hour. So, we see this in all aspects of life, and it's something you have to think about if you have kids out there. When you eliminate, if you teach your kid, if your kid only knows crossing the street with you, and you always hold their hand, and they're 9 years old, and they're 10 years old, at some point they have to cross the street on their own. And, all these little things that you have to allow your kid to take risks. Trust me, I know this well from a mother who, she doesn't let my nieces and nephews do anything.
The best term I heard for this was, we've heard of helicopter parenting.
That's
which
it.
Is,
yeah.
But this, no, the new age now, it's called bulldozer parenting, where they clean the way for
yes.
the kids.
Yes. Yes. Right. That's right. Remove every obstacle.
Yeah. The last iteration of parents just kind of watched everything. They hovered, but that was the helicopter. Now it's even to a whole other level. So,
yeah, that's right. And again, the coddling of the American mind, Jonathan Haidt, I think is well worth the read, especially if you have children. And what you potentially could be doing to your children, in that, but to bring it back to to sports or any sort of risk taking when we're talking about gambling aspect of this or trading, is you really need to be self-aware. And like I talked about, we've all got different risk tolerances. You know, did you watch The Last Dance? I'm sure you did.
Oh, yeah. Love it.
You got Michael Jordan's talking about, you know, they had the whole episode on his gambling. And what did he say? He's like, well, I don't have a gambling problem. I've got a competition problem.
Which, by the way, my bullshit detectors went off a lot there. Yeah.
Well, he's sort of right? Like, so he's sort of correct there. But the problem is, like, a lot of you listening to this have a similar type. More about winning, but that is going to lead to huge losses.
Well, the thing that he...
gambling, which then you could say, yeah, now you have a gambling problem.
The thing that he said that I thought was alarming, and again, it's not alarming because everyone can do what they want to do. I'm not going to police anybody. Was that he said that I'm not a gambling in some form because I still have my house, I still have my family, and that, you know, just because you could afford the losses, that means you're not an addict. I mean, that was the thing that was the kind of red flag of, but hey, listen, I don't begrudge him. He enjoys it, and that's it, you know. And I thought that getting mixed up with some of the nefarious characters is where I think he went wrong, and admits he went wrong. You know?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But it just brought me to a lesson for everyone out there is, and this goes, you'll hear me, if you watch enough of these podcasts, you'll hear me talk about be self-aware. In other words, when you're gambling, if you're a poker player, if you're not really analyzing the hands, both you won and lost, in an honest way, you're never going to get better. If everything is bad luck, you know, if I hear that the referee screwed me on that game, it was, the games are fixed, I tune right out. Like, then you're not serious about becoming better, right? The odds are pretty damn good that the referees in the NFL game aren't intentionally throwing the game to affect you. They're not doing it. I know we've had the case, you know, in the NBA, but for the most part, the games are not being fixed to go against you. And quite frankly, if the games were fixed, you're going to be on both sides of it. You know, sometimes you're going to get the benefit, but they're not fixed. And in poker, if every time you lose, it was just because you had bad luck. If you're not being self-aware and you're not analyzing and asking yourself the honest questions and then answering them honestly, then you are not. You're never going to improve, whether it be gambling or anything, any other aspect in life. So why I thought MJ was being honest in one aspect, as we touched on. Yeah, he has a competition problem, but if you have that same problem, and a lot of us do, where it's more about being right than it is about winning, and that's part of the lore of sports betting, is I can say I like a team, but until I put money on it, I really didn't. Right. So I don't really care what my friends think about a game, but when they bet on it, now it holds significance. Right. So again, it goes back to the, you know, we'll partake in riskier behavior. Like, well, I could tell you that the Giants are going to win the Super Bowl outright against the Patriots in 2007. But if I don't put any money on it, you know, what's the big deal? Your opinion means nothing to me.
No stake in the game.
That's right. Put money on it. It's like playing, you know, if you play poker, I've got buddies who are great at board games, hearts, spades, like, but if we're not playing, because we're not playing for money, and then you play poker and you put some cash on the line, they're suddenly, they become a lesser player.
Right.
So the cash element of it, incorporating the risk, and when there's no risk, it's very easy to be good at, you know, when there's risk, it takes on, it changes your whole body. It's the reason why sociopaths are so good. Sociopaths make the greatest traders and the greatest gamblers, right? Because they don't have the physiological changes that most of us do when we have some sort of risk, some sort of bet on the line. They just don't have that. They don't have that impulse. So you know, if you take all the good features, the intelligence or whatever it is to become a great trader, let's say on Wall Street, and then add in the fact that this person has absolutely is a sociopath, that's actually it's a formula for becoming very successful.
but it's a fire hose. It's great to put out fires, but it's hard to, you know, take a bath in a fire
hose. That's right.
You know, right. Yeah, no, that sounds like that is great. That's a good bit right there. I think that's a good place to end it as well. I'm sitting here with John Alicia, a.k.a. Statsational on Twitter, one of the lead coaches over at sportsbetarmy.com. Now is a great time to get over and join us at Sportsbet Army. Use the code BET, B-E-T, to join up. Sports are starting up again. We've never stopped over there at Sportsbet Army. We've been giving out our picks. Our models are posted. And as things get, there's a great community over there, Slack chat. So come check us out. Also in the description of this video, and if you're listening on the audio cast too, we'll put it in there. There's a great way to get 2 free months of Sportsbet Army by making a deposit in one of our affiliated sports books as well. We'll have you come on over, and things are getting back up and running. I mean, you hear positive things about NBA coming back. You hear certainly NFL is not even deviated one bit. I feel confident NFL will start on time. Too much money there. But NASCAR this weekend, right? And UFC picks being given out. So come check us out over there. John, anything else that I didn't hit on? Anywhere else they could find you other than Twitter and in the Slack chat?
No, that's it. I don't want anyone finding me in any other place but Twitter.
Knock on John, knock on John's door. Yes. If you have a question about betting, just go to his house. No problem. He loves that. Yes. I'm Alan Sislowski. I'm one of the analysts and providing all the content over at DFS Army. This year, in addition to being an elite DFS site, we are really building out a robust draft kit for season long and dynasty, and we already have some of our rankings up there. So come over there, DFS Army, and check us out. And you know, hit us up on Twitter. And I'm just going to give out a few others. I've put up an account over on TikTok now at Alan Sislowski, and on Instagram, Alan Fantasy Football, where I'm giving out free daily value just for fantasy football stuff. So if you love that as much as we do, come check us out over there. All right, for John Alicia, aka Statsational, I'm Alan Sislowski, and we'll see you soon. We're going to start putting out these Beat the Bookie podcasts once again on the regular, and I'll see you next time, John. Okay.
All righty. Next time.
Bye bye.